it's time for On Our Minds. With school out, it's family vacation season, and there's nothing like a road trip for family bonding. Kids in the back seat, parents up front, nothing but endless miles and miles ahead. The truth is, family vacations are often at their best in retrospect. For instance, some years ago, Mark Jacobson and his wife took their three kids around the world. Mark and his daughter Ray have remarkably fond memories of things many families would find deeply disturbing, like their visit to the famous burning ghats of India, the funeral pyres.
A ghat just means steps, and there is gigantic funeral pyres there, and these big railroad-sized ties of wood with these bodies on them. And how you find the burning ghat is simple.
You just follow your nose.
You follow your nose, or you can follow, you'll see these, in India they have a lot of rickshaws, you know, bicycle, trishaw kind of things. And you'll see these dead bodies, like, you know, in the pedicab, wrapped up, like sort of almost like mummies. And they're just sort of sitting there as if they were alive, but they're dead. And you just follow one of those and you'll get there. And then you go there and you'll see, and there are dead bodies stacked up, getting ready to go. And all the relatives are there, and they have these deals that you negotiate with what they call the burning ghat wala. A wala is like a merchant.
Wasn't there a fight you saw when you
were
there?
Yeah, there was a fight. Well, what happens is he sets a price because the wood costs a lot of money. But if the body is not totally burned, or if you don't pay the proper what they call bakshish, which is like a bribe of a sort, then, you know, it's too bad. You know, the body's not totally burned. They just take the body and toss it half burned into the river. And my
it's
children,
extremely heart-wrenching to watch.
My children found this to be a little upsetting.
He was surprised by that, too. This is a people who wouldn't let us watch commercial TV. We're shocked that, you know, this would upset us in any manner.
Ray,
none of us were
Ray,
kids.
Don't I remember that you and your brother and sister all turned to your dad and said, well, you pay. We have money.
Well, yeah, it was kind of like a, can't we please help? You know what I mean? Please? Because, like, these people are, like, screaming and fighting. And I were sitting there thinking, like, God, if this was, like, you know, mom or something, like, this is what she needed if we believed in something like this. Like, it would just be awful. So it's like, obviously, you know, everybody's somebody's mother or daughter or son or somebody important to someone. So you got to help where you can. But we didn't get a chance to.
We didn't react fast enough. They threw the body in the water while we were talking about what we were going to do about it.
Like under 2 minutes.
Did you and your wife debate at all about whether this was an appropriate thing to expose your children to?
Well, no. We went into it with this kind of like demented theory that anything that happened in the world would be okay for them to see. Of course, we didn't want to put them in any kind of danger or anything like that. But we felt that anything that people did that was basically a major portion of people's lives was okay for them to see.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel that any qualms about that whatsoever. There was a lot of complaining going on, but we thought that that was fine, too.
Now, you also took your family to the Genocide Museum in Phnom Penh in Cambodia. This is the place where the Khmer Rouge had tortured and killed some 20,000 people. What was that like?
It was incredibly upsetting, but worth seeing. Everybody should see that. I did a report on it when I was in high school, and no one in my class had heard of it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You say the Holocaust and everybody knows, but this happened in the like, 70s, and no one paid any attention because it was during the Vietnam War, and they used Cambodia as like the delta there. They used it as like a jumping off point to get into Vietnam.
What was at the Genocide Museum? What do you see?
Nothing, really. It's like, I mean, the most upsetting part is probably there's a room. You pass through one room. It's pictures of people, you know, holding numbers like mugshots, kind of. And then the next room is just like case after case of skulls. And that really is kind of like something that screws you up, you know. But in general, it's like it used to be a high school. And then when the Khmer Rouge came in, they turned it into this sort of prison. And now it's a museum, you know what I mean? It's like kind of slow, but just knowing the history makes it way more creepy than you'd ever think. We were there for about 10 minutes and I started to cry.
Were you angry at your parents for taking you there, or were you
no,
glad
I
you'd gone?
No, I asked to go. I asked to go to that particular place because I'd been interested in this. It seemed like something that needed to be seen. Like, people go to the Holocaust Museum. You know what I mean? They visit Auschwitz.
Mm-hmm.
sometimes if you, you know, it's good to see the worst of humanity so that you really get a better sense of what isn't worth complaining about. And also, you know, the greater picture and things to that effect.
Mm-hmm. I think 20,000 people were killed in that one building. The fact that it's right in the middle of the town, Phnom Penh's actually a wonderful place. I like it anyhow. And it's just this building, which is, used to be, as Ray said, it used to be a school. And it's right in the middle of the town. So on the other side of the wall, you see people going about their normal business every day, you know, just riding around, selling stuff, and just being regular people. And they have all the pictures that Ray mentioned. The thing that's kind of interesting about them is every person, because the Khmer Rouge were like the Nazis in the sense that they're very good record keepers. And they recorded a picture of every single person that died in the place. And you look at all these faces and you realize that each one of these people, they know they're about to die. And it's kind of overwhelming to think about that. And the fact that it's this place in this kind of prosaic setting, it stays with you. It's one of those things that stays with you.
Did you meet people in these places too? People who lived there, or were you mostly just kind of traveling around looking at things?
We met a lot of people, actually.
Yeah, we did.
When we went to Angkor Wat, we met this guy who was kind of showing us around a little bit. And both of his parents had been killed by the Khmer Rouge. And his attitude about it was just so uplifting in a way. He had this theory about the world continually going on, you know, despite the fact of where he came from, what happened to him when he was a kid. Makes you feel, as Ray just said, it's like really makes you, give you an idea about what you want to complain about and what you don't want to complain about. And I think it was kind of what we were hoping that would happen by going to this place, just that kind of osmosis of this larger universe.
Not everything about this trip was sad and dark, though. I mean, you did manage to have some fun. Mark, I was remembering a story you told about an encounter with a waiter in Cairo.
Well, yeah, that was kind of funny.
You got what you deserved.
When you travel around, you look for places that are kind of like feel okay to you. So since we're from New York and we're from Brooklyn and we're used to guys talking like this and all stuff like that, we got to Cairo, which is a big bustling city, which is not unlike New York City. But we got there late at night and there was no place to eat except this one place where they have this stuff called koshery, which is like Egyptian fast food. They had a menu on the wall, which had a bunch of other stuff. So we went in there and I said, I'd like to have this falafel and that. And he says, and the waiter is standing there looking very impatient. He's going, koshery and Pepsi. I said, no, yeah, that's nice, but I want to have this. You know, he says, and he just says, koshery and Pepsi. Then we go like, yeah, but I, you know, it says this, and that's what I want. You know,
mind you, everybody else got that the waiter was saying that they had only koshery and Pepsi, except for my dad.
So I'm going, like, I want a falafel and an orange soda. He says, like, koshery and Pepsi. So finally, he looks at me and says, don't you understand English? Koshery and Pepsi, that's what we have. That's what we always have. We've never had anything else. It's the only thing we have. So at that point, all the kids were like laughing at me because I'd been chumped by this waiter. So we thought, wow, this is a good place. We can live here because the people are like us.
Mark and Ray Jacobson, reminiscing about the family's 90-day trip around the world. Mark wrote about it in a book called 12,000 Miles in the Nick of Time.